You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
Up until now, they may have felt that the student movement was not serious, right? That they were just committed to holding up signs ineffectually on the sidewalk. But now, after seeing our commitment to take action, I believe that now they are willing to take our credibility more into some consideration.
On March 18th, 2011, the Liberal government, led by Jean Charest in Quebec, proposed tuition hikes that would begin in 2012, gradually increasing by 75% over 5 years. This would mean an increase from $2,168 to $3,793. Tuition had been frozen in Quebec much of the previous 4 decades, including a period of 22 years from 1968 to 1990 at $500. The government saw this hike as keeping up with inflation and asking students to contribute their fair share to the economy.
The Minister of Education, Lim Beauchamp, who ends up resigning as a result of months of massive protests the next year, said in one interview that tuition hikes had already been put off for so many years because they knew that students would protest. Even they, however, could not have predicted the sheer volume, longevity, and breadth of the response to the proposed tuition hikes that played out from February to September 2012. 8 months of an unlimited general student strike that broke records as the largest student demonstration in Quebec history and the longest student strike in Canada.
So, who are the key players here? Who was involved in the strike and how was it called for?
So there are three main union federations that represent students in Quebec. There's the FEC, or the Fédération étudiante collégiale du Québec, the FEUC, the Fédération étudiante universitaire du Québec, and AC, the Association pour une solidarité syndicale étudiante. So in English, these are the Federal College Students Association, which represents CEGEP students, the Federal University Students Association, and the Association for Student Union Solidarity. AC eventually created a strike coalition called CLASS, so CLASSE, in response to the proposed hikes, and eventually doubled its membership to represent about 100,000 students in the province.
It's important to note that CLASS had more of an emphasis on direct action and respected historic markers of civil disobedience, like occupying symbolic sites and disrupting the economy. They were often scapegoated by the media as the less legitimate federation, and the education minister attempted on more than one occasion to oust them from the bargaining table, painting them as violent and agreeing only to speak with what she saw as the more legitimate FEUC and FEC.
So if CLASS is a combative union, or they use combative unionism, what does this actually mean?
Combative unionism represents a set of strategies and practices that highlight that a union should be run by its members for its members. It should be autonomous and relies heavily on direct democracy, which requires general assemblies for each member to participate in discussion, rather than being represented from afar by someone they vote in. There are no special privileges or even hierarchical titles for its elected members.
It was really great to see so much footage of this in action, this direct democracy, in the film that we both watched, which is called Red Square on a Blackboard. And each person had time to air their grievances and ideas, and eventually everyone would come up with a compromise that negotiates all of it. Of course, combative unionism also relies on a militant core, which seeks to build itself as a counterpower to the interests of the state.
Class is a combative union, and the question of what constitutes direct action and whether this is within the bounds of legality came to center stage with the adoption of the Extreme Bill 78 in May of 2012, which essentially barred protest.
So Quebec has had student unions recognized by law since 1983, wherein students pay automatic fees and are automatically members of the union by paying tuition. We explored this in our second episode on the radicalization of the Concordia Student Union in the late 90s. So look to that episode if you want to hear a little bit more about this. Student syndicalism is obviously intertwined with class struggle in general, and it's important to highlight that early militancy around student unionization can't be divorced from the history of language politics in Quebec and the ways that the Anglophone elite ran the province for much of the 20th century. So, for example, Montreal only had one Francophone university until 1968, and the network of Université du Québec actually emerged as a result of major organizing to have more access to education for Francophones. So this really sets the stage for, I think, the success of 2012 in terms of a kind of a precedent for actually leveraging unions in really huge ways.
Plus que tu y penses, plus que tu vois que c'est bien plus profond qu'un chiffre, tu sais, ou qu'un pourcentage, ou que quoi que ce soit, tu sais, la hausse des frais, tu sais, ça s'inscrit dans quelque chose. C'est l'économie du savoir, c'est la marchandisation de l'éducation.
It goes deeper than the tuition hikes. It's about the knowledge economy and the commodification of education.
Assez was born out of the anti-globalization movement of the early 2000s and actually had a campaign called Plan Legault. François Legault was the education minister at the time, and so they were calling out his courting of big business.
Historically, Assez has been at odds with FEC and FUC over the issue of direct action and whether or not to denounce violence, which the government has used to divide support among them. Also, FEC and FUC are not combative unions and are more in a kind of lobbying and research kind of framework.
Most of the time, what's meant by violence in this context is things like the occupation of offices and blockades, or any kind of civil disobedience that falls outside of a really docile protest.
We see this kind of distinction between what constitutes legitimate protest come up a lot of the time in 2012, with the important difference that associations stuck together this time in union and didn't splinter in the face of tactics to paint one as like more legitimate than the other, for example.
There were protests going on since the announcement of the hikes in March 2011, including a one-day strike and occupation of the finance ministry office.
Assez's plan was to do a massive information campaign and stage a one-day strike and demo in November.
The one-day general strike happened on November 10th, with 200,000 students on strike and 30,000 participating in a march. If the government didn't respond favorably to this demonstration, formal efforts to organize an unlimited strike would follow. And this is exactly what we see happen.
So CLASS, the Coalition Large of Assez, the more expanded version of Assez that had existed before, comes together shortly after this November demo with more than 60,000 members that eventually grows. A few weeks later, FUC and FEC also announced their intentions to join the strike. So on February 13th, the first student unions at UQAM and Université Laval vote to initiate a strike action. In the following weeks, thousands of students follow suit in their respective student unions.
Pour la proposition 460, contre 448.
Des étudiants dans certaines universités ont commencé.
Les étudiants des Cégeps Saint-Laurent, Valleyfield, les associations.
By March, more than 120,000 students are on strike, and what the government had initially dismissed as a puny Marxist faction can no longer be laughed off.
Now let's talk about the climate in general between, I guess, Francophone and Anglophone university campuses. We've seen a major mobilization among campuses clear across the city, including Concordia and McGill University. How do you feel about that in relationship to your participation in previous movements? Is there somewhat of a link between the languages today than previous mobilizations?
Yes, there is definitely a link. Before, I was there in 2005, 2007. When it came to McGill, it was assumed that McGill would never join a movement or a strike movement, as well as Concordia. It was like, you know, we won't even try. But people tried, and it worked. And I think that's a big difference. There's also CLASS. has put a lot more efforts into élargissement, so enlarging the strike, and they put people to send to these campuses, people who spoke English and could help organize over there. But also, it came from within, too. I mean, you know, just at McGill, there were occupations. Class didn't say, you know, go occupy. It was all from inside, and I think that's really different, and it just, like, gives way more hope because you never assume things, and yeah, that's that.
In early March, Concordia students vote to join the strike, amending the vote so as not to prevent non-striking students from attending class, and they're the first major English language school to join the strike. The Concordia Student Union, or CSU, and the Graduate Student Association, GSA, both called strikes throughout, along with other departments like engineering, computer science on the graduate level, and geography in both graduate and undergraduate levels.
Hi, it's Catherine for CUTV. I'm in front of the Hall building, and we're heading to the march.
On March 7th, the Concordia Student Union voted in favor of joining the National Student Movement Against Tuition Hike. Around 1,800 students attended the General Assembly, the largest General Assembly that has ever happened at Concordia. Today, March 15th, marks the first day of the strike, and the CSU is kicking it off with a protest in the downtown campus.
What's your name?
Patrick. I support the cause entirely. I just think that education should be accessible to everyone, not just a certain caste in society, I guess, and that's why I'm here.
My name is Anthony Garofalo Soji. People have got to understand that a strike by definition is that we do not go to class, and that we have picket lines to encourage people not to go to class. And we can also have hard picket lines to actually block people from entering the building. We have to have some sort of disruption at this university if we want this tactic to be effective. And that's why I'm standing in front of this door right now.
We voted to go on strike. We met the conditions of our associations, and these picket lines are therefore valid, and we should be respecting them.
In early March, class votes to adopt economic disruption as part of their strategy, so leaning a bit more on the militant side of their combative unionism, occupying and blockading offices such as Lotto Québec, the Liquor Board, and the Plan Nord Conference for Mining Companies in Quebec.
And so from this point, clashes with police start to become a lot more intense. Cops begin using flash grenades, and at the Lotto Québec blockade, Francis Grenier is blinded in one eye, making him the first of two people to lose an eye over the tenure of the protests. Mass arrests become more common, and organizers have to prepare strikers for this reality.
March 22nd is the historic day that sees as many as 200,000 people march in the largest protest to date in Quebec. By this time, 310 of the 400,000 students in the province, so more than three quarters of them, are on strike.
After 9 weeks of striking, some colleges order their students back to school, and pickets are set up with obliging students being called scabs. Some individuals obtain injunctions to be able to return to class, while protesters chant, moi, 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 accusing those returning to class of prioritizing their desire not to lose one semester over the long-term collective movement.
Those who are initially against the strike, or who maybe were for it but have grown tired of it, begin to wear green squares in retaliation or response to the red squares that had been representing the anti-hikes. On the other hand, this divide of the university and college admin ordering students back to class actually ends up bolstering some kind of legitimacy for the strike among those who are more neutral, who see for themselves the sort of conservative and reactionary nature of the justice system, where you're able to grant injunctions against these collective bargaining.
The pressure on the government to reach a negotiation is mounting, and when the Minister of Finance, Beauchamp, finally agrees to talks on April 15th, she does so on the condition that each association openly condemn the violence of protesters.
While FUC and FEC oblige initially, CLAS cites the need to consult its General Assembly first on their official position. So going through the very long, hard, and slow kind of process that they do with their General Assemblies to make sure that everyone's on board. In solidarity, eventually, FUC and FEC refuse to join negotiations, saying that it's all of them or none of them.
On April 23rd and 24th, after negotiations with these three associations, the proposed revisions the Liberal government has offered at this time seem openly provocative, proposing just to delay the hikes by a few months, and even proposing that instead of 75% increase over 5 years, that they would hike by 87% over 7 years.
This lack of good faith, or what seems like kind of an intentional provocation, sparks 100 nights of back-to-back protests. So students reject their offer outright. The chant, "This is not an offer, this is an insult," rings out in Montreal.
From April, class begins to more explicitly frame the struggle as a popular movement against neoliberalism rather than a student issue. The slogan, "Students are on strike, but the people are in struggle," is seen everywhere on banners.
The month of May sees several more violent protests, most notably one in Victoriaville, which resulted in a second person losing an eye and someone else sustaining a major head trauma at the hands of riot police. The question of violence and rioting becomes central in the media, and class is called on again to denounce it.
On May 14th, Lynn Beauchamp resigns as education minister, taking responsibility for failing to be able to manage the crisis and also citing that she's lost confidence in the student leadership's will for it to end at all. Michelle Cochin replaces her.
4 days later, on the 18th of May, the incredibly contentious Bill 78 passes. It was an emergency law titled "An Act to Enable Students to Receive Instruction from the Post-Secondary Institutions They Attend." So obviously framing this as students have the right to go to school if they want to go to school. And this suspended the semester until August and introduced steep fines for anyone who was initiating a strike. The bill also stipulated that a route must be approved for any demonstration of more than 50 people. Picket lines are rendered illegal, and Montreal, as a city itself, implements bylaw P6, which is a ban on wearing masks at public protests.
This is the moment when community members at large began showing up in droves, defending what they saw as the democratic right to protest, regardless of their personal opinions about the tuition hikes. People engaged in snake marches, defying orders to give a route to police in advance.
This is the impetus for the Conseil des Casseroles, in which people banged pots and pans every night at 8 p.m. and in demonstrations, exercising their right to continue to protest.
On May 22nd, given that protests had basically been declared unlawful, the largest act of civil disobedience took place in Quebec, with 200,000 people manifesting. There's a great clip of spokespeople from class responding to the tabling of the bill and saying that they will risk going to prison if that's now the consequence of protecting their rights to exercise dissent.
Si ces pratiques nous valent des poursuites pénales en vertu de la loi 78, nous nous engageons aujourd'hui à faire face à ces poursuites. Pour nous, le droit de manifester, le droit de s'exprimer est fondamental et ne peut pas être brimé.
At the end of May, there are 4 days of talks between the government and student leaders, which end without a consensus. Cochin says they are at an impasse, and student leaders do not feel that they are being taken seriously in negotiations at all. On the 1st of August, Charest calls for a general election, hoping that a silent majority will show up to put an end to the crisis. Student unions focus energy on getting the Parti Québécois to commit to canceling the hike, and the Parti Québécois has been, since pretty much the beginning, openly against hikes and courting favor among people like the students.
On September 4th, 2012, it's announced that the Parti Québécois won the election, and Minister Pauline Marois immediately cancels the hike and implements instead a small increase indexed to the cost of living in its place. And over the duration of the strike, there's more than 40 reported injuries, some very extreme, and more than 3,500 arrests.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
So my name is Adrien Welsh, and in 2012 I was pretty much involved as a student in the student movement. I was actually at that time a student at Cégep du Vieux-Montréal, and from there on I kept doing political activism to the point that now I am the leader of the Communist Party of Quebec and also member of the Central Executive Committee of the Communist Party of Canada. The 2012 student strike, that was perhaps one of the most intense moments in my activism and one of the reasons for why I kept being involved in activism. That played a very important role for sure in my consciousness awakening. And I'm sure I'm not the only one there. If you look at the number of people who today are, you know, labor unionists, people who decided also to find, you know, their path into the progressive political movement in Quebec, a lot of them came from the 2012 student strike. I guess, you know, when I say it was intense moments, well, that's roughly at the peak, the most heated period. You know, we would have some disruption actions in the morning, quite early, you know. We were out sometimes at as early as 7 in the morning until maybe 11 a.m. And then some of us had to, you know, find a job or work to just survive. When we had time, we would go to some assemblies. When those people say that it was not a democratic process, well, it's not true again. Everything was decided collectively, and there was a high level of democracy. Actually, I think it was an example of a democratic movement. And depending on the day, and then often also at night, there were night demos, which would sometimes finish as late as midnight. We had to sacrifice a lot of time for the cause that we were fighting for. That was also a very, I'd say, a moment that I can say of effervescence, a moment of frenzy, really. And we really, really, a moment of hope, too. We really believed in what we were doing. This is maybe the main thing that I take back from there, that struggle brings us to what we need to achieve for a better world, more social justice, and so on.
Can you speak more to why it was so important and why keeping tuition affordable is so important?
Well, I'll say first of all, I still believe it is as important and maybe even more important now than it was. And why? Well, I think this is just part of a much broader struggle. François Legault, before being Premier of Quebec, he was Minister of Education under the Lucien Bouchard government. And that Lucien Bouchard government, in 2 years, cut $4 billion in healthcare and education, in public services, that is. So we are seeing a pattern here. We're cutting money for public services, and we're injecting them to private corporations so that they generate more profits. And that is, you know, our tax money. That is just being funneled, the working people's tax money, the students' tax money, the youth money that is being funneled towards profit-making big businesses, sometimes multinational businesses. So in that context, basically fighting for free education is not demanding a favor. It's just saying, and it's the same thing for free healthcare, by the way. It's the same thing for free childcare. It's the same thing for, you know, Canada Post, the maintaining of Canada Post. This is money that the working people are making, and it should come back to the public.
How do you remember the opportunities that came up over those 9 months or so? Did you see it as a kind of learning opportunity as an activist, or did it just kind of happen along the way? Yeah,
no. Definitely. I mean, when the strike vote was taken, I was already convinced for years before that I would vote in favor of that strike. I knew that from a theoretical point of view, and what that student strike showed me is that, well, the forces exist on the ground, and what I learned is, you know, well, how to make a point in a general assembly, how to write leaflets, how to, you know, convince people who otherwise might not have been convinced, how to talk to people, how to organize. That's what this student strike really brought to me, the importance of having organization in order to win what we want. In 2022, for the 10 years since the beginning of the 2012 strike, there was a small rally that was organized. As someone who remembers that period, I made sure that I would be there. A lot of the leaders from 2012 were not there, and the people who were sort of commemorating it were commemorating it as a failed movement. It's, of course, in the struggle, when you struggle, there are setbacks that eventually happen. And were there setbacks in 2012? Obviously. Did we win everywhere on all? No, we didn't. But I don't agree with anybody who would say that the 2012 movement was a failure. I think it was a very important success. And the main success is that we were able to build a balance of force that really frontally challenged the Jean Charest government, which was back then the official representative of the power of big business in Quebec. And I think that's a very important lesson from 2012. The demand was very clear. It was a very tangible demand. It was no more of this $1,625 tuition hike. Now, that's not the most radical slogan. That's not a slogan that, you know, will bring about revolution or topple the regime. Of course not. But that's a demand that almost 500,000 people was able to rally around. That's a demand that very early on was supported by the labor movement. That was a movement that, further down the road, was supported by any democratic groups that were opposed to the privatization of public services. So from the get-go, it became a struggle that's not just about education. It's about defending our public services and expanding them. It was about, you know, working class rights as well.
This whole movement is kind of about liberating ourselves from the control of the government, of corporate interests in general. And I think that doing something like playing music, like dancing, things that are not necessarily associated with spontaneous public display, is something that challenges these kinds of dynamics, that challenges the rules about who can be in the street when.
My name is Dani Tardif. I am now a queer artist living in queer rural Quebec. but at the time I was a student, I started my undergrad in anthropology at Université de Montréal in 2010, and I joined the student association the first month of my undergrad, and very soon after we started doing some activism around the future strike. So I was really, really involved.
Yeah, so you said you joined the student association. Can you clarify what that was or what you were part of?
Oh, yeah. So Université de Montréal works by local associations. So we have a larger one. That's La FICUM for the whole university. But it's not... It works a bit like a student government. So our direct democracy comes from our local association. So it was like the undergrad and grad anthropology student association.
Can you describe a little bit more how that evolved for you? Like, did you feel like you were swept up into something? Did you feel like you were radicalized? Did you have any prior kind of involvement in any kind of political organizing that like set the groundwork for this? Or did you meet people that sort of brought you into the fold in a way?
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I was already very political. I became an anti-capitalist when I was 15 or 16. You know, at CEGEP I had a grant, so I was able to go to a private school for CEGEP, and it radicalized me a lot to be around kids who were much, much more rich than me. So when I arrived at the undergrad in anthropology, I was going in that field also because I wanted to have a voice, I wanted to understand political systems and how it impacts society and cultures, and I got a position. And at UDM, we started to have an inter-association groups for mobilization. I think Concordia had something similar. And I think that's really where we became more radicalized, because we were able to find like-minded people. And not so long after that, we joined ASSE, which was a national association that started the strike, or like called the strike. Since the 80s, there's been two... it's like a big story. There's been like two big field of how people organize, right? You have like you had the version of it that was more reformist and closer to the government. So you have like the La FICUM, La FERC, La FEC. And at the time, there was another student association that was closer to direct democracy that was coming from the 68 movement and La Révolution Tranquille and stuff like that. That association eventually dissipated, and there was like other association that came in and go, and ASSE was just one of the iterations of that. So the goal of it was to mobilize, radicalize, and organize students together so that they could defend their right as students, but from a direct democracy perspective.
La classe, en fait, c'est la coalition large de l'ASSE. Donc, c'est l'ASSE qui est à la base de cette coalition-là. Le but, c'est d'ouvrir les structures de l'ASSE aux associations étudiantes qui ne sont pas membres habituellement pour le temps de la grève.
I want to hear in your own words why keeping tuition rates down is important, and if you think that there is like a particular, I'm not sure if it's a different set of goals or aims for like 2015 and current organizing around it, but at least in 2012, how were you thinking about that, and has that changed?
Okay, I'm going to try to be true to my mind as a 21-year-old student. But I remember that the discourse at the time, we were aiming for free tuition. That was our political agenda, and we want education as a means of liberation of the people to be the most accessible possible to everyone. We were trying to articulate the discourse to dismantle the austerity that was starting to materialize itself in Quebec. And I think that this seemed to be a very concrete simple way to target our discourse into a feasible, measurable fight. And there was a lot of debates in the student movement around this issue because a lot of people disagreed with centering the strike over this specific issue. But that was what was the most rassembleur, you know, what was like the extreme left and the center left would agree on to fight together around it. Because there's different kind of strikes. You can have an offensive strike asking for more rights or more advantages. And then you have defensive strikes. And at that moment, we thought it would be more, we would have like more massive mobilization around the fact of like blocking the tuition to make sure to keep it at least then. And from then, people would be more inclined to listen to what we had to say.
Mm-hmm. In your like tenure at SA or over 2012 and maybe beyond as well, do you feel like there were opportunities to learn and develop skills as an activist? Can you paint a picture of how the community building side of things actually went? Like when you're showing up at demos, maybe meeting other community members outside of your university or within?
It was very pedagogical in the sense that I've been trained to do most of the things that I learned, and then I trained other people to do this, and I definitely did learn so many skills from organizing a general assembly, presiding a general assembly, organizing mobilizing committee, doing one-on-one mobilization, being able to debate in at the assay. We often were like 100 delegates debating for 2 or 3 days about like our different positions. We also had trainings about how to organize demonstrations and actions, how to do street medics. I took my official retirement from the student movement, deciding that I would never get involved again because you become a has-been really fast. I think it was in 2016 because I was involved in a 2013 strike that was very short, and the 2015 strike at Concordia was at Concordia at the time. And I was also I was really sad about what was happening in the state of the student movement. And eventually I was like, well, I need to let that go. And people are doing whatever they can with the tools that they have. But before finally retiring, I co-wrote a book with a few of my friends about the different autogestion, like self-management, like DIY organization that was at UDM from the 1900s to 2015, to make sure that there was somewhere a record of what we did. Because at some point I left for Chile in a student exchange for 6 months in 2013. And when I came back, no one there knew about how to organize an assembly. And I was like, wow, it goes so fast, so fast. And that's why having a federal national association is important, because then you have people who have actual roles to be able to transmit this information.
No, that's something that's come up a lot. I mean, especially doing research on student activism. I mean, the thing about students is that it's so ephemeral. Some people are only there a couple of years and then move on, maybe even move out of the city. So it's such a sort of transient thing. It's hard to like maintain that kind of memory.
But that's interesting because that's a very Anglo experience. Francophones don't leave the city. When I was there, it was very easy to contact people who've been at other strikes or who was still around helping and giving training. Like, people were not leaving, they were still around.
So my name is Aaron Lakoff. And I was a Concordia student. I did my undergrad and a master's in communications at Concordia. And I've been involved in a lot of different kinds of radical activism in Montreal over the last 20 plus years I've been living here. I finished my undergrad in fall of 2011. And then the student strike started. So at the time I wasn't a student, but I had just started working. I got a very brief contract at CKUT Radio. I was the news coordinator there for a little bit, right when the strike was starting. So that was exciting because we were covering it on our daily news program, Off the Hour. And then in June of 2012, I was hired by CUTV at Concordia to be the news director there. That was really exciting because CUTV kind of got famous during the student strike for sending these crews out into the nightly demonstrations and live streaming. And this is before live streaming was like a really big thing. It was like kind of early days of live streaming. And so we would do it in a pretty funny way. Like we would go out with like a proper big video camera and these big backpacks. The backpacks would also serve as like transmitters. So they'd be like sending the video feed like back to our home base. And then it would go out like on the internet from there. It was an exciting and inspiring time. So I would go out several nights a week with our news crew and do these live streams, which I think were fascinating in and of themselves because people use them or consume them rather in all sorts of different ways. So I know a lot of people would tune into the live stream just to like kind of find where the protest was, right? Mm-hmm. Like the protest would start every night, 8:30 p.m. at Place Émilie Gamelin, and then they were snake marches. So they weren't led by anyone in particular. The decisions about like which streets to march down were made very organically and spontaneously in the moment, which was incredible because it made it really hard for the police to like intercept them. And then they would go like all over the city, right? Like, someone would go into the heart of Westmount to where Jean Charest, Premier of Quebec at the time, like actually had his mansion. Or a lot of them would like go far up into the Mile End and Petit Patrie, Little Italy. You would just kind of like wait for the protest to come by your house and then go out with your pots and pans to join it. And so people would tune in to like get information that way, but also like to transmit like messages to each other. So I just remember like people would be like shouting each other out on the live streams all the time. It was kind of like a way for like protesters to communicate with each other. And then of course, like also just to document the police brutality that was happening. And I actually got arrested when I was live on camera reporting for CUTV. It was the night that the Grand Prix was happening in Montreal. And I was very clearly marked, like, you know, I was wearing a press badge. And we were down, like, right in the heat of things at the corner of Maisonneuve and Crescent Street. And I had my microphone. I'm, like, live on the air. And then a second later, I'm being tackled by a cop who's got a knee in my back. And handcuffed and thrown into the back of a police cruiser. I didn't get charged with anything. They just like held me in this police cruiser for about 20 minutes to half an hour and then just let me go. And then I was like, you know, I'm here as a journalist, mm-hmm. right? And then they said something ridiculous like, oh, but you're wearing a red scarf around your neck, so we thought you were a protester. I was like, well, yeah, like I was wearing a red bandana because you guys pepper spray everyone, and so I had it for my own protection. You can still find that video clip. It's up on YouTube. I think if you search, like, CUTV reporter being arrested, you can find it.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! Hey, 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 what are you doing? He's pressed!
Erin est en train de se faire arrêter maintenant devant nous. Erin est un journaliste qui travaille avec nous à CUTV.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
The police repression was a big element of that strike. From there on, when, you know, it was pretty much clear how bad it was, then there was those pot demonstration, empty pots. Mm-hmm. And that was not just students. That was pretty much everywhere. And just anybody who was for democracy at the end of the day, not necessarily in favor of no more tuition hike, not necessarily people who agreed with the student movement and the methods, but just like, come on, this is just their democratic right to be demonstrating. It's their democratic right of assembly that is being targeted. I just can't be on the side of the repression. So they just went down. So it became basically a democratic movement from one demand to a democratic movement. And unity was a key factor. The unity of the student movement was a key factor. There was a big awakening that was going on at that time that was way beyond just the student movement, although the student movement was sort of the driving force, but it was very big, and it was really not by the speeches, but really in the facts, in the streets, in the labor movement, because back in the end of the spring, the labor movement on the floors, in assemblies, were discussing for real, and they were submitting resolutions for solidarity strikes, which is illegal in Quebec to go on strike outside of the framework of collective bargaining. Now what the labor movement was saying is, this is our struggle too, we've got to help the students, we'll pay the price we have to, but we're going to go on strike with the students. And that was very challenging. In the recent history of Quebec, it's the last moment where there was such a challenge to the Charest government, to austerity, and to basically the power of big business, which are the ones ruling the game, even now.
It was such an inspiring moment in Montreal. Like, I'll never forget the May of 2012 when the government passed its special law, which essentially they were trying to outlaw these big nightly demos. And that really like pushed things over the edge. And then it became much larger than a student strike, right? Like, that's when it became a real social struggle. And I'll never forget this moment of just being out in the streets with my neighbors, right? Like, people who I'd never spoken to except to say like hi and bye in passing. And then all of a sudden you had these neighborhood marches started. So like, there would not only be the big nightly march that would start downtown, but also like marches would start in like Villeray and Petit Patrie and like Verdun, and they would all like kind of like coalesce eventually. And that's when people brought out the casserole, like the pots and pans. It felt so cool, and it really filled my heart just to think like a month ago I barely knew you, and now here we are breaking this law and marching together in the streets illegally. And it really encapsulated the spirit for me at the time.
Finally, the first minister of education, or probably higher education, Lynn Beauchamp, finally decided to meet with the student movement, with the student union. Well, all the student unions. So there was some sort of a round table, if I'm not mistaken, it was in Sherbrooke. When I'm saying organization, I'm stressing this, but the student movement was not just people who were giving speeches out of nowhere. There were like, you know, accountants that were hired by the student movement, economists and all that, who were preparing briefs and all that, and all sorts of documents to help give substance to the demands and give arguments. Student movement was very well prepared. And that was going on for hours and hours. And eventually, you know, basically, the government was saying, we can't, absolutely can't freeze the tuition hike. We need to proceed with this. We need to go ahead with that. You know, and they would come with numbers and you know, with some sort of an arrogant vibe to it. We have numbers. You're just, you know, kids. You won't know that. Yeah, well, we have numbers too. If you did this and this and that, then you would have money for this. And eventually, Lynn Beauchamp basically burst and said, well, it's not about economy, it's about ideology. That's exactly it. It's not a question of numbers, it's not a question that we cannot afford free education. It's just a question of who are you ruling for? Are you ruling for the corporations or for the majority of the people? So at the end of the day, you've got to challenge the power of big business. And that is done at this stage, I believe, in Quebec and in Canada, through convincing the mass movements, whether it's the student movement, unions, women's movement, all the democratic movements that are out there, that we have one common enemy, and that this enemy, to defeat it, we can't just be struggling everybody in our, you know, little struggles. We need, first of all, to bring ourselves together. And second, that this has to be done not just through the streets, but there needs to be some sort of an independent mass political action, because we cannot trust any parliamentary groups or parties that are there right now.
I don't necessarily think the 2012 strike is successful, you know, so I feel pretty bitter about it, like most people who were involved that I know of. But I think the context of Concordia and UDM is wildly different, and it has more to do with the Anglo system that's proper to McGill Concordia versus the other universities. But the way CSU works is very similar to the way FICUM works, in the way that it's, even though the government, like quote unquote, the student government is leftist and it's great, it doesn't really work as a direct democracy, or like it could, but the culture is different there. And it's very hard to change a culture. But also I had a very different experiences than a lot of my other colleagues who were there, because I was in the grad school. And at Concordia, the grad school have one massive association and they're all together. And that was really brutal, because you have all the grad school of all the association, and I think that's a really poor political strategy. And I'm not sure that the UQAM system is better necessarily. When I was at UDM, everyone laughed at us because UDM is supposed to be so hard to mobilize. But I really, with respect, I really enjoyed having to do all of this work to make sure that all UDM was on strike, because we knew everyone. we were responsible for our 300 people, and we knew each other. So when we went to the demonstration, we would hold each other, we would be together. And maybe we had less numbers, but I think that the percentage of people who were showing up was maybe bigger. And in that sense, it's maybe similar to Concordia. For example, at UDM, we had to picket every one of our classes. And at UCAM, they would pick in the morning, and then the class would be lifted for the whole day. But the thing, it was frustrating to have to go, but it also meant we were needed to be there, and it meant that we were there together.
Tell me about the participation of students this week on the picket line. There were actually picket lines at McGill University, including around some English classes. What was the interaction like? Was it generating a lot of awareness among students?
There have been a variety of different picket tactics. Some have been more aggressive, especially on the first day, and we decided to err away from those because we really want to warm people to our way of seeing things and get them onto our side. So in the past few days, we've just been walking into classrooms, having a discussion usually, and often professors will opt to cancel the class, or students are so in solidarity with our message that they leave themselves. That's what's been happening, especially yesterday.
You were talking about you didn't necessarily think that 2012 is successful. Do you want to speak more about that? Or even if that's a useful framing to think about movements as successful or not?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think for many people, the 2012 student movement was extremely violent. And I think that's the part that we forget. It was not like a yoo-hoo, like a pacifist movement, like wide, massive. It became very radicalized, very violent, really fast. And I'm talking about the police violence, of course. We had so many friends who lost limbs, their eyes were brutalized. I have so many friends who went in jail, so many friends who were arrested and had criminal conditions for years after that. People couldn't talk to each other. People were raided in the night. And then eventually when the summer came and then the teachers joined and the parents joined, like then people just forgot about everyone who were bruised and traumatized. It's hard because I feel bitter about it and I don't want to be biased by my emotions to how to analyze like the political sphere. But I think people had really big dreams and were willing to sacrifice a lot for it. And in the end, when it was the time to decide if we would go back or like accept what they were offering us, I think most of the students felt betrayed. Or anyone, those that had been in the street every day for 8 months, most of them felt betrayed. And most people I know from that period went into massive depressions after that. Massive. But it was also a moment of pure joy and connections and friendship, and we learned so much. Like, I don't regret it, but I don't think we got what we were expecting out of it.
Could you speak to what you think is the difference today, if any, and you know, why there have been tuition hikes since then and drastic ones also in Quebec, and there hasn't been the same kind of real rallying that we saw 13 years ago?
So what is obvious in terms of struggles that come to mind, which kind of fed into 2012, would be the Occupy movement, which I believe was, I want to say, 2011.
Yeah.
So that was like a big populist progressive movement all across North America. And, you know, to me, it's fascinating because, like, when we think of populism today, we think about it, like, in terms of, like, the far right and Donald Trump. And, like, it's important to remember that not long ago, we had this moment of general uprising where, you know, Occupy was just everyday people coming out and wanting to talk about, like, the financial crisis and how, you know, capitalism is screwing over the 99%. Also, like, I think it's important to mention, like, the year before, 2010, was a really big mobilization in Canada. People called it, like, fuck 2010, where there was, like, a big Indigenous kind of coast-to-coast mobilization against Vancouver Olympics. There was the G20 that happened in Toronto that summer. You also had the Arab Spring, right? So like the revolution in Egypt, the uprisings that happened in Tunisia, Algeria, Syria. And then of course, you know, like the Maple Spring was like a riff on that, right? Mm-hmm. Like for me, it felt like our social movements were really strong and there was an incredible momentum. I think in the aftermath of that, a few things happened. One is that I was pretty disappointed to see the leadership of that student movement kind of get co-opted by the political class or the political system. So now, of course, you know, Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois is co-porte-parole Québec Solidaire. For me, that's always going to take the wind out of the sails of social movements when you start to realize that, like, these leaders are just kind of in it for, like, personal gain and their political careers. And, you know, as far as politicians go, sure, like, Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois is, like, not that bad of a politician, but I think he would have been more powerful as, like, a community organizer had he stayed in that role. And so that's one thing. And then I think the ASSE doesn't exist anymore, right? So the ASSE was, like, the more militant student association that was part of the Maple Spring. And I think that's kind of the nature of the Quebec student movement is the organizations also go in cycles. So I remember ASSE was formed in the early 2000s and they continued to exist until, I want to say, a few years after the student strike. I'm always, like, fairly confident that the student movement will regenerate itself, will get it back on its feet. It's also just, like, it's the nature of student organizing because people don't stay students forever, right? Like, and I think that student activism is always drawing on its past and drawing its hit from its history. Like, we're trying to get this thing done, but other people have tried this before, and how can we do it better? And I see a lot of examples of the work improving, and it makes me happy. Montreal, to me, was, like, huge. It was legendary, you know, before I'd moved here, because we were always just hearing, like, about all these, like, badass actions and organizers and organizations that were happening in Montreal. So to be able to come here and be a part of that myself was just, like, one of the biggest, like, honors and privileges of my whole life.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
When we're talking about 2015 as another kind of moment of student strike against tuition hikes, do you think it's because there was a kind of absence of a plan for sustaining the one goal kind of mentality?
What I saw in 2015 was some sort of an upsurge of frustration rather than a well-thought, built movement that is looking at things in a long-term perspective. The student movement should be part of a broader movement that fights for, yes, free education, free healthcare, expansion of public services, and many other demands that, of course, no one can come and say, you know, this is our list of demands and it's a take it or leave it proposal. A lot of people during those, you know, months of the 2012 strike really became seriously more, I don't like too much the term radicalized, but just more conscious. More conscious of, you know, the need to struggle. A lot of people learned that. And I don't think that this is something that you learn from books or something that, you know, you learn from speeches. You learn by doing it.
Can you speak a little bit about how the 2015 organizing against tuition hikes was, how it played out, I guess, from your perspective?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying it's, like, better or worse, but I think the people at the core of the organizing of the 2012 strike had a very, their intention was to have the wider movement possible, and that was helpful for the people who were more radical in their tactics. You know, we were diversity of tactic kind of team because they were protected by the masses, and ideologically, politically, like, or for direct actions and stuff. I think the difference in the 2015 movement is that it stemmed from parts of bitter, I'm gonna say, like, I think effects are important, that but bitter, disappointed, radicalized students from the 2012, and people who were not there during 2012 and just looked at the images, right? And then necessarily it was not the same people who were for 2 years every day at the metro station giving flyers. And so 2015 felt a bit more like, and I don't know for, I'm not an expert in the situation, you know, and I was at Concordia, so, you know, I think they had a bit more of a, not necessarily insurrectionist, but, like, the flyers that they would bring up was much more like, let's take the street and let's burn and let's rejoice in the destruction of the world, which is very poetic and I'm not against it at all. So they were not necessarily claiming to have a massive popular movement. They wanted to have like more effective, smaller actions, but without necessarily the masses to protect the people. So I think there was like a lot of very short, very intense actions where people got arrested and brutalized. So it was not the support of the population, and it got really violent really fast, and I think there was less mobilization on the ground. So it's a bit like la tyrannie de la non-structure, which I don't know, I love anarchists, you know, like that's not, but I think there's a way to organize as anarchists to and making sure that people are safe and that you're not using the people to accomplish something, you know what I mean? It felt like this. I'm not sure how it really went because I was not close to those people, but from the external, it felt like that.
Do you have anything else you want to share about that time?
Well, I think something I could share is that now whenever I see people from that time, I feel like we're still connected from an invisible bound. Like we know each other, even if we've maybe never talked to each other, because I know that we've been through the same things and that we've experienced an experience that no one else did. Like it was very particular to that time, and it was very intensive and all-encompassing, but it was also very formative. And I think that even the people that I disagreed with at the time, I think in a way maybe understands me in ways that other people will never. So that's very interesting. And I made a documentary in 2013, like an ethnographic documentary about the people who had been arrested and had liberation conditions, because they couldn't talk to each other. And so we went from houses to like take their voices, and then we would go to the other houses to show them what other people had said. And I think that's something that was very touching for me, because it felt a bit like when people disappeared, they just disappeared. But so many people were still affected by this for so long. And it really shaped how I think about social movements now, and how I really think that when you're building movements, it just takes so much time, because you want to go to the space of the slowest person to make sure that there's no holes and that we can hold each other. Because I think there was a feeling of using people as soldiers. And when they're falling and we're moving on over their bodies kind of thing. Like no one died, but I think it could have happened.
Can you tell us what the name of the book you co-wrote was, and then also the name of the documentary you just mentioned, and if there's any way we can access it, or people listening can access it?
Yeah, the book is called Mementum, Histoire de l'autogestion à l'Université de Montréal de 1913 à 2013. It's at the bank, at the library. It's at the UDM library too. So there's a few places where you can access it for free and read it. And the documentary is not online. I guess the only way is to ask me, and I'm really happy I can send it to anyone. It's called On a gagné, regard sur une victoire amère. So yeah, it's like I felt bitter at the time. I still feel bitter about it.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
Piper, what were your thoughts that came up while we were researching this? And you know, what's your personal relationship to the strike? Were you living in Montreal at the time? How have you kind of come to think of it in the legacy of it, how you've heard about it over the years?
So I was living in Kingston, Ontario in 2012, where I grew up, and I was involved in CFRC, the campus community radio station there. And that's where I learned about the 2012 strikes. You know, they had the red squares there. So I took a red square, I put it on my backpack, you know, only half understanding what that really meant. But I heard students are striking for tuition or against tuition hikes. And so obviously I thought, well, I support that. That's kind of all I knew about it. But at the same time, you know, when we set out to start our research for this episode, I feel like I was really like, oh yeah, 2012 tuition hikes. I know exactly what happened. I know what that was about. And then as we got into our research, it was like, wow, there's so much I didn't know. I didn't know about, you know, the major groups. I didn't know about the level of like direct democracy and organizing that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I think that something that became clear as we're studying this is that there is quite a gulf or a segregation maybe between the Anglophone universities and the Francophone universities. And that is partly explained by, you know,
a lot of people at Concordia and McGill, for example, are coming from elsewhere, so maybe they're not as invested in what appears to be a Quebec politics. But then also that there's not, as you've explored in other episodes, Francophone students or Quebec students are much more aware of a kind of precedent of student organizing and solidarity through these federal student associations, and not just, you know, your anthropology student association or grad students association, like these kind of higher level huge bodies that negotiate for you. And I kind of had a kind of disjointed experience. I was in Montreal in 2012, and it's become clear to me maybe some of the reasons why I also felt in some ways alienated from it, because of not having this like grounding that maybe someone in Quebec had. But I think for me, there's always been this legacy of 2012 as this really enormous moment of like collective action and like beautiful solidarity between people. And like, I think I have my own personal affects around it because I feel like I was there and also not there. Like I was in my second year at McGill. I actually lived like literally 50 meters from the Cégep de Vieux-Montréal. Like I lived on Ontario and Saint-Denis. So I would go up on my roof and like watch every single night, like people go up, because that was such a major area that people were like gathering and marching through. And I remember thinking, you know, it's such a no-brainer. I obviously support this free education. I'm still in my awakening as an activist, but it didn't even occur to me to go and join in, basically. And I think this is partly maybe to do with some kind of lack of awareness that it like affects me in the ways that it did. But I think beyond that, there's also a kind of imposter syndrome maybe, where I thought, you know, like this is their fight, great for them, I'm gonna cheer from the sidelines. And like talking to other Anglophones I know who have been in the city as long as I have, who absolutely were there and like made a lot of friends through that time, and like, you know, it was so central to their political awakening.
Yeah, well, I think something you were saying when we were having our pre-production chat too was that a lot of Anglo students are out of province or international, and so weren't affected in the same way by these specific tuition hikes, and so again might have not have felt the same stake or like the need to heed the call to action.
Yeah, exactly that. And then also symbolically, what a tuition hike represents in Quebec versus elsewhere is different. Jean Charest's government was really trying to frame this as this is just inflation, you have to do your fair share, you shouldn't be passing the bill to someone else, you know, where is the money going to come from if not from your tuition? And we've already frozen it so many times, kind of thing. And elsewhere in Canada, that might be more begrudgingly accepted, but accepted nonetheless. Mm. And in Quebec, I think it actually feels very personal, because there's such a history of actually successful organizing around hikes, and understanding that education and access to education is like so materially connected to wellness in society, and, you know, access to power and like the circulation of knowledge. And, you know, it's considered much more of like a right maybe than other places in the world. And I think like that's a good thing and should be protected. But even at the time, I was kind of like, how do you think they kept it so low? It's not like they've just been getting a favor. Like, this is a continuation of the kind of work that's been done.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also this idea that you can kind of postpone a hike, like, okay, we froze it then, and now we've got to claw back everything that it would have increased to if it hadn't been frozen all this time. And we see that happening with rent right now. The Tall just announced that they're going to increase rent by 6%. And they're saying that this is in part because they didn't increase it during the pandemic. And it's like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
It hasn't been increased because people can afford it, and we have a right to affordable housing the same way we have a right to affordable tuition.
Yeah, you were speaking about how it was interesting or eye-opening to have insight into some of the strategies of the federations like CLAS, how they actually exercise direct democracy, their thoughts around direct action and how they support that, and just different kinds of solidarity with each other, and then also the kind of like other splintering factions that maybe would show up to their demos but weren't necessarily represented by them. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
something that was really interesting that came out in like your interview with Danny and what we saw in the film we both watched, Red Square on a Blackboard, is the kind of like learning and mentorship that was going on. Like class, they weren't just saying, okay, come show up to the strike and be there. They were really preparing people for what that meant and how to be on the ground and how to be in solidarity. They were giving like media training, workshops on safety in demonstrating.
Yeah, it's really cool to see that mentorship that you mention seemed to be part of an explicit strategy that they were building an activist community. They recognized that they were investing in something that would maybe take a little while, but that it would eventually pay off because they're literally like constructing good activists and people who actually were aware of what they had to do to keep each other safe, like what it meant to confront police, like what it meant to vote in an election, to like pass a motion, like all those things. And when reading a bit of Assez's own writing on their position, they refer to what they call an escalation of tactics, which is this idea that in order to get people kind of in the door, they organize relatively benign actions such as flyering or not low stakes necessarily, but not like high risk activities. Like they're getting people in who maybe have not been awakened necessarily yet to like all of these like interlocking structures of power. And by getting them in and like getting them trained, they eventually sort of like escalate their tactics so that people who maybe would shy away from anything that would potentially result in arrest are now in a place where they see that as something that they actually are down for and is necessary. And that brings us to speaking of violence and police brutality and this question of whether these protests are violent or not, and how there are some that are quote unquote successful because, you know, hundreds of thousands of people marched and nothing happened versus the ones that get labeled as violent, and how the different spokespeople of the student federations are asked to reflect on that. Klaus actually really impressively, I think, negotiated that. At least, you know, we saw some examples in the film of the press releases they put out where they could have easily denounced any kind of fringe group and like they weren't with us. And at least to my knowledge, I never really saw them do that. They weren't like openly inviting people to commit crimes, but they were saying that the normative bounds of legality are actually not conducive to our rights to exercise dissent in these cases.
Yeah, it's such a distraction tactic and a tactic of sowing division within movements. I think that class resisted that division really well, and Feck and Fook as well, by staying in solidarity with class and not going to the negotiation table without them. It was really, really key in this movement lasting as long as it did. And it's funny, you know, at the beginning of the film, we keep mentioning, you see someone say like, oh, you know, this could last as long as 2 weeks. And then 6 months later. Yeah, something that I found really impressive is the core organizers and people from class are constantly invoking the long-term struggle and really trying to avoid getting bogged down in the short term. And I think when we're looking at whether or not this movement was successful, looking at the long-term struggle, I think, is really important. And we don't have free tuition yet, so I would say they haven't succeeded or failed. It's ongoing. But in terms of the immediate goals of that movement, when I look at it, I do think of it as a success. The government was forced to call an election. They were changed out. And the primary goal of canceling those extreme hikes was achieved.
Despite what happened in the end, or what we continue to face in terms of massive tuition increases, the reframing or the success in framing this not as just a student struggle or kind of this niche issue is, I think, for me, like the greatest success, in that like a lot of people actually were persuaded that this was something that is really interlinked with other social justice, and the threat of neoliberalization on the well-being of everyone was really highlighted really well, I think, by people who participated. And the participation by people outside of the student movement speaks to the success of that.
We've got to struggle, mm-hmm. because what's coming up is going to be very nasty. And the student movement has a real big role to play in this. With Trump in the US, possibly Poilievre here, perspectives are not desperate, because there is hope, and the hope is in the struggle. But if we don't struggle, that is going to be, let's say, a very rough ride. And I don't look at it with nostalgia. I look at it as this was an important moment collectively for the struggle, to learn from it, to get ready for more struggles. And I'm hopeful that there's no other way around, that there will be more of that.
Thank you to Danny Tardif, Adrian Walsh, and Aaron Lakoff for their interviews. Our volunteers Onyx and Cassandra for their work on this episode, and to the CRFC Radio Meters program for funding Discordia. To access Danny's ethnographic film, visit their website dannytardif.com. That's dannitardif.com.
2012 soundbites are from CUTV's livestream archive and the documentary Red Square on a Blackboard by Santiago Bertolino and Hugo Sampson. Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, SoundCloud, and Spotify.
Tune in on Monday, February 24th at 6 p.m. for our next episode of the 2017 Me Too Movement at Concordia on CJLO 1690 AM and cjlo.com.